From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I urge Congress to move as quickly as possible on behalf of the American people. For every day we wait or point fingers or drag our feet, more Americans will lose their jobs. More families will lose their savings. More dreams will be deferred and denied.
President-elect Barack Obama warns the economy is sliding into a deep economic crisis. What does this mean for your pension or 401k? What does it mean for Social Security? We'll speak with Teresa Ghilarducci, author of When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. Then, well, three quarters of a century ago, another incoming president took his oath of office amidst the Great Depression.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
We'll speak with Adam Cohen, editorial writer at the New York Times, about his new book, Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. But first, Obama's inner circle. The president-elect is expected to name his intelligence team today. Leon Panetta for the CIA, John Brennan as a key White House advisor, and Admiral Dennis Blair as director of national intelligence. Is this change? We'll speak with investigative journalist Alan Nairn. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel continues its devastating assault on the Gaza Strip despite a UN Security Council resolution demanding a ceasefire. Overnight, Israel launched more than 50 strikes, killing at least 12 Palestinians. Seven people were killed in a bombing in northern Gaza, including an infant. At least 24 Palestinians were killed Thursday, including three elderly people fleeing their homes. Palestinian militants responded with around six rockets into southern Israel earlier today, causing one injury. At least 60% of Gaza's 1.4 million people have no electricity. Many are without clean water. Gaza's fragile sewage system also risks collapse, stoking fears of a worsening health crisis. Overall, the Palestinian death toll stands at least 778, including more than 200 children. At least 3,250 Palestinians have been injured. 13 Israelis have died over the same period, four soldiers by friendly fire. The Security Council voted 14-0 for the ceasefire, with the U.S. abstaining. The measure calls, quote, for an immediate, durable, and fully respected ceasefire, leading to the full withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. This is Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki.
But al-an, Sayyid al-Rais, ala Israel.
Israel, the occupying power, must immediately implement this resolution. Aggression must cease so that we all may have the opportunity to work to heal the wounds of our people and to rebuild what the brutal Israeli war machine has destroyed in Gaza.
The measure came hours after the UN shut down major aid operations in Gaza after Israel attacked one of its aid convoys. Israeli snipers killed two Palestinian aid workers who were reportedly trying to retrieve the body of a colleague who'd been killed in a previous Israeli attack. The killings reportedly came during the three-hour pause to the bombing agreed to by Israel to allow humanitarian relief. UN Relief spokesperson Christopher Gunness.
I can confirm that UNRWA has suspended its operations in Gaza because of staff security. We've had a shooting of a driver in a convoy clearly marked as a UN vehicle. There have been a number of attacks in which UN facilities have been hit with direct hits and others. We've had no choice but to suspend our operations until we can get guarantees of the security of our staff. We've lost staff been killed. We've had no other choice.
The UN says it's lost all confidence in Israeli pledges. Israel's attacked several UN and medical installations this week, including a UN school where 46 civilians were killed. According to the World Health Organization, 21 Palestinian medical workers have been killed and another 30 injured in the Israeli assault on Gaza. The International Committee of the Red Cross, meanwhile, said it would scale back aid operations for at least a day after one of its convoys also came under Israeli fire. The Red Cross made the announcement as it accused accused Israel of blocking access to a bombing site where several emaciated children were found next to their dead mothers. Overall, dozens of dead civilians were found in a one-block span of the neighborhood of Zaytun. Red Cross Mission Chief Katrina Ritz described the bombing's aftermath.
I think one of the big shock was that these people were very weak. They were children, being next to their dead mother. There were no assistance given to these people. There were around 18 wounded, which have not had medical aid, and very, very weak people. The children could hardly stand. There was no water for them. There was no food, and they were with other dead bodies.
In a report Thursday, the UN said 30 of the victims killed in the Zaytun attack had been taking shelter in a home on orders from the Israeli military. More than 100 Palestinians had been evacuated there and told to stay indoors. Palestinian paramedic Atiya Barami was among the first to reach the victims.
The Red Cross got permission for us, for three ambulances, to enter the northern area of Gaza. We found bodies that the tanks drove over. The medics checked the bodies and found damage at the cellular level and bodies. This baby girl, aged 5 months, she has been dead more than 2 days. The dogs ate part of her body. The baby was burned because you can see her face and body are dark and charred.
Most of the dead were members of the same extended family, the Samunis. The death toll was initially lower, but rose as more bodies were pulled from the rubble. The Israeli attack is under increasing international criticism. On Thursday, a high-ranking Vatican official, Cardinal Renato Martino, compared Gaza to a concentration camp. Speaking to an Italian daily, Martino said, quote, "Look at the conditions in Gaza. More and more, it resembles a big concentration camp." Meanwhile, former President Jimmy Carter has denounced the Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip. Writing in the Washington Post, Carter criticizes Israel for breaking the six-month ceasefire by launching its November 4th attack that killed seven Hamas militants. He also faults Israel for failing to uphold its commitment to ease the humanitarian blockade of Gaza. Protests, meanwhile, continue worldwide. On Thursday, more than 40,000 people demonstrated in Oslo, Norway, denouncing the attack on Gaza. According to Al Jazeera, other rallies were held in Venezuela, Tehran, Khartoum, and Sarajevo. In Canada, around 30 activists occupied the Israeli consulate in Montreal. The action came one day after a group of Jewish Canadian women occupied the Israeli consulate in Toronto. In New York, hundreds gathered on Wednesday to respond to Mayor Michael Bloomberg's open support for the Israeli attack. Bloomberg visited Israel last week and gave interviews backing the assault on Gaza. New York City Councilmember Charles Barron said Bloomberg doesn't speak for all New Yorkers.
My message to Bloomberg is shame on you. How dare you speak for all New Yorkers and ignore the fact that 560 people died and many of them innocent women and children. How dare
protests. Protests also continue in Israel. Israeli peace activists Uriav Neri and David Wilner were among those demonstrating in Tel Aviv.
We are here to protest against a war which we consider inhuman, immoral, totally unjustified and unnecessary. We believe that if we had agreed to talk with Hamas, this problem would have been laid aside a long time ago.
A massacre and violence is not the way to bring peace to both nations, the Israeli and the Palestinian nations.
As the United Nations and the Red Cross condemn the Israeli assault on Gaza, the U.S. Senate approved a measure overwhelmingly supporting the attack. The non-binding measure passed by unanimous voice vote. Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid and Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell both spoke in favor of the Israeli invasion. Reid said, quote, "When we pass this resolution, the United States Senate will strengthen our historic bond with the State of Israel by reaffirming Israel's inalienable right to defend against attacks from Gaza, as well as our support for the Israeli-Palestinian peace process." The House is expected to pass a similar measure today. Congressmember Dennis Kucinich has been one of the few lawmakers to speak out against the U.S.-backed attack on Gaza. Kucinich has asked the State Department to probe whether Israel's use of U.S.-supplied weaponry violates the 1976 Arms Export Control Act. The Guardian of London's reporting, meanwhile, the incoming Obama administration is planning on reversing the Bush administration's refusal to negotiate with Hamas. The Guardian says President-elect Obama's leaning towards authorizing low-level contacts with Hamas that could eventually turn into more serious talks. Hamas has said it would support a settlement with Israel based on a full Israeli withdrawal to the 1967 borders. The Bush administration's refused to recognize Hamas despite its 2006 victory in Palestinian elections. In other news, Obama's appointed former CIA official John Brennan is his top aide on counterterrorism. Brennan had been Obama's top candidate to head the Central Intelligence Agency, but was forced to withdraw from consideration amidst protests. Brennan has publicly supported the CIA's policy of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques and extraordinary rendition. Brennan's new position doesn't require congressional approval. The Obama transition team, meanwhile, is reportedly working feverishly to overhaul the $700 billion bailout of Wall Street. The Washington Post reports Obama aides are focusing on setting clear restrictions on the condition for government aid. The Treasury Department will need congressional approval for the second $350 billion installment of bailout money. Obama spoke about the economy on Thursday.
We should have an open and honest discussion about this recovery plan in the days ahead. But I urge Congress to move as quickly as possible on behalf of the American people. For every day we wait or point fingers or drag our feet, more Americans will lose their jobs. More families will lose their savings. More dreams will be deferred and denied. And our nation will sink deeper into a crisis that at some point we may not be able to reverse.
A congressional oversight report expected for release today criticizes the Treasury Department's handling of the bailout, faulting what it calls, quote, significant gaps in Treasury's monitoring of the use of taxpayer money. At Guantanamo, 10% of prisoners are now being reportedly force-fed. The Pentagon says 25 of the 250 prisoners are being fed through tubes up their noses. And an update to yesterday's headline on a protest Wednesday in Oakland. At least 105 people were arrested demonstrating against the killing of an unarmed transit passenger by a Bay Area police officer. The officer, Johannes Messerly, resigned early Wednesday before he was to meet with investigators. Cell phone videos show Messerly pulling out a gun and shooting 22-year-old Oscar Grant in the back while he was lying face down on the ground on a subway platform. Grant worked as a butcher at an Oakland grocery store and was the father of a four-year-old daughter. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. And Amy, in another update to a story, a segment we did yesterday, the Service Employees International Union had this emergency of a meeting of their executive committee, a 40-member executive committee by phone yesterday to act on what they were going to do with the United Health Workers west of California. And apparently Andy Stern was not able to immediately get a decision by his executive board. There appeared to be some opposition to the move. And Stern instead pushed through an electronic vote of his executive board. And the results will be available around 2 p.m. today. So we won't know for sure what they're doing. Some of the executive board members were saying, as I'm told by sources, that they were asking, why do we have to do this now when we have a face-to-face meeting in about a week of the SEIU? Why is Stern pushing this through?
And for listeners and viewers who missed yesterday's broadcast, the significance of what Andy Stern and the SEIU is trying to do right now?
Well, this is a major attempt to consolidate one of the most important locals in SEIU and remove the leadership of the United Healthcare Workers West, which has been one of the most vocal internal critics for more union democracy within SEIU. And I have to note also that, you know, on this show, we often criticize the corporate media for failing to cover major stories. I have to say that some of our press in the progressive community have also been lax. Organizations like The Nation magazine have not covered this issue at all. Neither have Common Dream. Dreams, the progressive website. In fact, I know from direct experience that over the last year, two columns that I wrote in the Daily News that I tried to get Common Dreams to disseminate, which they normally do on many of many columns around the country that have to do with SEIU, their takeover, their attempted takeover in collusion with the Puerto Rican government of the Puerto Rico Teachers Union earlier this year, and then in the past week, this battle within SEIU. For some reason, Common Dreams has declined to disseminate those columns. And I think that we need to take a look at some of our progressive media and how they're covering this important labor issue as well.
And there's also word that SEIU could re-merge with the AFL-CIO?
Right. Well, there's a discussion now between the AFL-CIO and the Change to Win labor unions that broke a few years ago away from the AFL-CIO. Now they're talking about re-merging again. And as John Sweeney, of course, the AFL-CIO president, is expected to retire very soon, and question of who will succeed him now as either the president of the AFL-CIO or as president of the merged labor union again, a movement will soon be determined.
I think earlier in the year, Esther Kaplan in The Nation did cover this issue, but in the most recent case, we haven't seen that kind of
coverage. No, we haven't seen much in The Nation on this issue at all. Nothing at all.
Well, to today's top story.
Yes, well, President-elect Obama is expected to name his intelligence team today. Leon Panetta for the CIA, John Brennan as a key White House advisor, and Admiral Dennis Blair as director of national intelligence.
I think what you're also going to see is a team that is committed to breaking with some of the past practices and concerns that have, I think, tarnished the image of the agencies, the intelligence agencies, as well as U.S. foreign policy. Last point I will make, though, on this is that there are outstanding intelligence professionals in the CIA, in DNI, and others. And I have the utmost regard for the work that they've done, and we are committed to making sure that this is a team effort that's not looking backwards, but is looking forward to figure out how are we going to serve the American people better.
Is this change? John Brennan was dropped as a candidate for director of Central Intelligence due to accusations of support for torture and extraordinary rendition. This is Brennan speaking on the PBS NewsHour in 2005.
I think it's an absolutely vital tool. I have been intimately familiar now over the past decade with the cases of rendition that the U.S. government has been involved in. And I can say without a doubt that it has been very successful as far as producing intelligence that has saved lives.
President-elect Obama is now selecting John Brennan for a position not requiring congressional confirmation. Admiral Blair, as Alan Nairn reported on Democracy Now! On Tuesday and Wednesday, was implicated in the backing of perpetrators of church massacres in East Timor in 1999. Award-winning investigative reporter Alan Nairn joins us on the phone again today with more information on potential new problems for Admiral Blair. Alan Nairn, welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us what you know at this point.
Well, in addition to supporting General Wiranto as he and his forces were massacring churches and killing more than 1,000 civilians in Timor in 1999, it now appears that Blair either lied to or willfully misled the U.S. Congress. In testimony given before the Senate Armed Services Committee on March 3, 1999. In that testimony, Blair discussed the fall of the Indonesian dictator Suharto. Suharto fell in May of 1998. And Admiral Blair, in his prepared statement, made the following statement. Throughout this process, the Indonesian armed forces have played a difficult but generally positive role. While there were instances of individual or small unit violence against Indonesian citizens, military leadership firmly supported the Constitution. Moreover, the incidents of abuses, shootings, and kidnappings that were reported are now being investigated and the perpetrators punished, end quote. Now, that is simply false. Almost every element of that statement is false, as anyone who is familiar with the situation in Indonesia at that time could tell you. It was not individual small units, but top Indonesian military officers led by General Prabowo, who carried out the Kopassus kidnappings of activists known as the Rose Team kidnappings. Not only did this involve senior officers, but those senior officers were U.S. trained. And the specific Kopassus intelligence units doing the kidnapping had a liaison with the U.S. Military attaché in the embassy, and General Prabowo was a longtime U.S. protégé. The senior officers of the Indonesian military instigated anti-Chinese riots in which their agents rampaged through the streets, burnt houses, conducted mass rapes of Chinese and other women in the streets, a model of mayhem that was used 1 year later in occupied East Timor. They were also involved in the killings of protesters in the streets. And Admiral Blair tried to tell the Senate Armed Services Committee that the Indonesian military leadership had firmly supported the Constitution. Well, he had to know when he submitted that written statement that shortly before Suharto was falling, the Indonesian grassroots movement had announced a mass demonstration. And it was widely anticipated in Jakarta that this mass demonstration might draw a million people and that it would lead to the downfall not only of the individual dictator Suharto, but of the entire military establishment. So what did General Wiranto, the commander of the Indonesian Armed Forces, do? He told the organizers that if they held this demonstration, they would get a Tiananmen. They would be massacred by the military, and in fact, they called the demonstration off, with the result that Suharto, the individual, fell, but the military institution run by Wiranto remained intact and dominates within Indonesian politics to this day. So Admiral Blair was either lying or willfully deceiving the Senate Armed Services Committee on March 3rd, 1999.
It's also interesting, Alan Aaron, that the president-elect Barack Obama actually has personal ties to Indonesia and knows very well what happened in Indonesia. In fact, he wrote about it in his first book, in his memoir, in his autobiography.
Yes, and one of the, Obama makes several very good observations, and one of them is that he says the fate of Indonesia has been tied to U.S. foreign policy. And it certainly was in 1999 when the militias, organized by the forces of that same General Wiranto, rampaged across occupied East Timor, massacring churches as they went. And what Admiral Blair did in response to this was to meet with Wiranto on April 8th, 1999, not only reassure him, but even offer to get him new IMET military training, which had been cut off by the U.S. Congress. So Admiral Blair was essentially offering to side with General Wiranto, the mass-killing General Wiranto, against the U.S. Congress to try to get the military aid restored for Wiranto and his men. In the days after that, Wiranto, of course, was very pleased by this meeting, very encouraged. They increased the killing. On April 17th, they rampaged through downtown Dili, the capital of Timor. They took the son of one of the prominent Timorese leaders, Manuelito Carrascalao. They executed him. And the next day, the very next day, Admiral Blair called Wiranto again, reaffirmed his support, offered him still more U.S. aid. And within 5 days after that, the Catholic Church was reporting that in rural villages in occupied Timor, anywhere from 42 to 100 villagers had been executed by militiamen in the days immediately after Blair's call. And after that, it just got worse, including events like the burning of the bishop's house, a massacre at the diocesan office, the church massacre of perhaps 200 people at the church in Swai, the assassination and rapes of clergy. It just went on without end.
And Alan,
and this is backed by the United States, backed specifically by Admiral Dennis Blair, who Barack Obama today at 10:30 in 2 hours is reportedly going to nominate as the new U.S. Director of National Intelligence unless people weigh in to stop it.
And Alan, your sense of these appointments, what they will mean in terms of any possible change in the U.S. policy, at least in toward Indonesia and that part of the world?
Well, that's a very good question, but the implications now are not just Indonesia. I mean, Blair happened to have been involved in these, in sponsoring these crimes in Indonesia and Timor, but now Blair will have authority for the entire world if he gets this job, as already do people like Robert Gates. Obama's team has said he wants to abide by the rule of law in intelligence and foreign policy. So, in 99, in Indonesia, Timor, did Admiral Blair abide by the rule of law? If Obama thinks the answer is no, then he should prosecute Blair, not appoint him. If Obama thinks the answer is yes, that was abiding by the rule of law, then that means it's okay to sponsor mass killings of civilians, and doing that earns you a promotion in Barack Obama's Washington. People can call the Obama Transition Office because there's still 2 hours before this appointment is announced, and it's not over till it's over. This is still a press leak. It hasn't come out of Obama's lips yet. The number is 202-540-3000. 202-540-3000. That's the Obama Transition Office. Their website is www.change.gov. And also people can contact the East Timor Action Network at etan.org, www.etan.org. They're running a petition campaign to try to stop the nomination of Admiral Blair.
Alan Aaron, I want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning journalist has reported on Indonesia and East Timor for many years. In 1999, he broke the story on Dennis Blair's secret meeting with the Indonesian General Wiranto, and is unveiling more information. And these hours before it looks like Dennis Blair will be appointed Director of National Intelligence. Alan Aaron's website, Alan Aaron, AllanNairn.com. Coming up, we will look at the economic crisis with Teresa Ghilarducci. She's author of When I'm 64. Stay with us.
Older, losing my head many years from now. Will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
When I'm 64, the Beatles, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
For the 50 million Americans with 401k retirement plans, 2008 is a year many wish they could forget. Workers saw their 401k plans lose between 20 and 30% of their value as the Dow Jones Industrial Average suffered its worst year since the Depression. Between October 2007 and 2008, more than $1 trillion worth of stock value held in 401ks and other defined contribution plans were wiped out. For workers nearing retirement, the losses have been devastating. Meanwhile, several major corporations have recently announced they're suspending matching contribution to workers' 401k plans due to the economic crisis. The firms include FedEx, Motorola, General Motors, Starbucks, and Sears. Congress is now considering overhauling the 401k program.
Our next guest, Teresa Ghilarducci, testified before Congress recently and proposed establishing a system where workers pay into a government-managed fund that would offer a guaranteed monthly pension at retirement to supplement Social Security. Her plan's been intensely criticized by the finance industry. One columnist described her as the, quote, most dangerous woman in America. Teresa Ghilarducci is the director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School for Social Research. She's the author of the book When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. Well, I'm sure we're risking a lot here, having the most dangerous woman in America sitting next to us, but we're willing to take the risk. Professor Ghilarducci, explain what's happening now in light of all—well, Obama just spoke on the economy yesterday.
Right. It's really the end of a 30-year experiment with a do-it-yourself pension system. The United States stood above all other nations in saying, look, we're going to hand over this savings managing and investing responsibility over to individuals. They want control. The stock market is healthy. The finance industry told people that all you had to do was invest in the stock market, wait for a long term, implied that that long term would end at the end of your working career, and you would have enough to live on for the rest of your life. And that experiment is over. It failed. And just like the Great Depression, just like the policies proposed in the Great Depression that brought us Social Security, I think we're at that point now where we have to rethink that experiment and rethink how we get people their Valentines, their pension Valentines.
Well, when you say this experiment, I mean, there was an enormous shift in terms of the percents of employees who are getting what's called defined benefit plans as opposed to defined contributions. How did that happen, and how big was that shift?
Yeah, well, in the 1970s, we passed a law that said that if companies were going to promise a pension, they had to fund it. That was ERISA. And that was a good idea. But then only about 50% of Americans at any one point in time had a pension. But the pension was a traditional pension called a defined benefit pension. Even though half had it at the time, it meant that as people got older, they often got into jobs with those kinds of pensions. So we are seeing right now.
And by defined benefit, that meant that they were guaranteed a certain income per month when they retired.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It was based on years of service and on pay. So lower income workers got less, higher income workers got more, but that was fair. The point is that it was guaranteed for the rest of a person's life. And that's precisely what people want when they retire. They don't want to be rich. They don't want to make it big in the stock market. That was always seen as something you did in Las Vegas or with money on Wall Street, money that you could afford to lose. The idea is that pensions were supposed to be secure for the rest of your life. And we now have a system where older people who are retired have Social Security and their pension on top of that. And we have the great success story in America was that we went from the 1950s, where to be old meant that you had a high probability of being poor, to a situation now, even though it may be at risk, it may be over, where if you are old, you could actually count on some income. Thank goodness we have Social Security.
Well, what about what are called the entitlements? In fact, Barack Obama referred to entitlements yesterday. What do you see as the future of Social Security, of these pensions?
Well, a comic said that George Bush's best success was to try and privatize Social Security. And why that was funny was because it was his largest failure in his initiative for bold domestic policy. It meant that in 2005, when he tried to do that, that Americans realized how much they had at stake in Social Security. Barack Obama, I predict, just can't touch that. There was a huge political movement against privatization, and that movement said, stop, we need this program. I just can't imagine Barack Obama going anywhere near that entitlement.
But there has been talk of the possibility of him creating some kind of a payroll deduction for a 401k type program for American workers on top of the Social Security, hasn't there been?
I hope so, because that's actually what I'm proposing. Mm-hmm. I'm proposing that we have a mandated, a universal supplement to Social Security. It's not an old idea. It's just something that I am bold enough to suggest. It would be a supplement to Social Security, but it won't be an individually controlled, an individual won't have to go out to retail, you know, mutual funds, pay these high and hidden fees, wouldn't have to decide what kinds of investments to make, wouldn't have to be exposed to the risk of the stock market. And most importantly, at the end of their working life, they would get a guaranteed annuity on top of Social Security. That's what we need. We need a supplement to Social Security. And if he's talking about that, I'm glad.
Well, in terms of that, how would yours work? The money that would be contributed, where would it go?
Yeah. What we would do is mandate that everyone add another 5% of savings on top of Social Security. That money would go into a government fund. It would be run much like the pension fund for federal employees are run now. This huge sovereign wealth fund would be dedicated to all Americans, supplement to Social Security, and it would be invested in a broad portfolio of assets, government bonds, municipal bonds, infrastructure bonds, private equities, private stocks, emerging markets, but it would be professionally managed. Again, much like my pension fund is, and much like much like the federal employees.
We're talking to Professor Teresa Ghilarducci. Her book is called When I'm 64. Retirement age is going up. What is the significance of that?
Well, it's going up because we had a lot of low-wage jobs being created. And so Americans were working longer, and American women were especially working longer. What it means when you raise retirement age is usually it means that you're cutting back pensions. And I don't think it's sustainable. There is no way that we can actually have a retirement system that's based on having people work longer. We see now that a recession, that's just ephemeral. It's just a fantasy.
I think the labor statistics are going to come out later this morning, right. And we're talking about half a million more people being put on the unemployment
rolls. Yeah, it's unimaginable, you know, that rate is so large. But it does point to the idea is that we can't have retirement policy based on people not retiring. That's not a retirement policy.
To go back to your plan and the opposition to it by the financial community, they obviously would like to be able, to, if there is going to be some kind of a plan for additional employee savings to manage those funds, right, and absolutely. Collect all the fees. It would be a huge payday for Wall Street.
Yeah. But it would be hugely inefficient. We actually had those experiments in Argentina and in Chile and in Peru. In Chile, Peru, and Argentina, those experiments came about when there was a suspension of democracy. The most dramatic cases were in Chile and Peru. And we found out after those 20 years is that people are not retiring with enough money to live on, mainly because those private individual mutual funds, those little private companies, they charge fees that are too high. They have to provide profits to their shareholders, and they have to they actually have to advertise. So it's wildly inefficient. So my plan, any plan that requires employers and employees to save more for the retirement, we have to. That's actually the fact. We're going to live longer and retire. We do need to save more. But we can't do it through these Wall Street boutique retail firms.
It's interesting. You work at the New School, which is the president is embattled. He is Bob Kerry, the former senator. And it was years ago that he was heading, he was a Democrat, but heading the commission to look at privatizing Social Security.
And that commission rejected that proposal because most anybody who's practical looks at the issue, and privatizing is just not practical. It's inefficient. It requires people to do what they can't do, which is to bear the risk of their own retirement that they can't control when they're 65 and to face the financial markets.
Teresa Ghilarducci, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at New School University. Her book is When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Juan?
I think we're going to take a break for a minute, and then when we come back, we'll be talking with Adam Cohen.
Dr. Dog, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, in a major address on the economy, President-elect Barack Obama warned yesterday that the nation is sliding into a deep economic crisis and called on Congress to pass a stimulus package quickly.
I urge Congress to move as quickly as possible on behalf of the American people. For every day we wait or point fingers or drag our feet, more Americans will lose their jobs. More families will lose their savings. More dreams will be deferred and denied. And our nation will sink deeper into a crisis that at some point we may not be able to reverse.
The current economic crisis has often been cited as the worst the country has seen since the Depression of the 1930s. At the time, over 10,000 banks had collapsed, one quarter of American workers were unemployed, and people were fighting over scraps of food. At the height of the Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt took his oath of office, pledging to reverse the crisis. On March 4, 1933, Roosevelt delivered his inaugural address that contained one of the most famous quotes ever made by an American president.
First of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. We face our common difficulties. They concern, thank God, only material things. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no market for their produce, and the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone. More important, a host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return. Only a foolish optimist can deny the dark realities of the moment. And yet we are stricken by no plague of locusts. Compared with the perils which our forefathers conquered, we have still much to be thankful for. Nature still offers her bounty, and human efforts have multiplied it. Plenty is at our doorstep. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truth. This nation is asking for action, and action now. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credits and investments. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency. These, my friends, are the lines of attack I shall presently urge upon a new Congress in special session, detailed measures for their fulfillment, and I shall seek the immediate assistance of the 48 states.
An excerpt of FDR's first speech as he took over the reins of the White House and laid out his plan for change in the midst of an unprecedented crisis. We're joined now by Adam Cohen. He's an assistant editorial page editor for The New York Times and author of a new book called Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle in the 100 Days That Created Modern America. This is his first interview since the book's publication. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Well, you say in this book, it's not just FDR himself.
That's right. The story of the 100 Days is often told as an FDR story, and he did do amazing things. That speech we saw was beautiful, mobilized the nation. He did fireside chats. He was very effective in working with Congress. But there was a second level of people underneath him, his inner circle, that really developed the policies that came out of the 100 Days. And these are critical policies, the first federal welfare program we ever had, the first major public works program, things like that. And it's other people, Francis Perkins, who we saw perched in the background behind FDR, in the photo there when he was signing the Social Security Act, Henry Wallace, his agriculture secretary, Harry Hopkins, the first federal relief administrator. These were crucial people who have been lost a little bit to history.
Well, in terms of how their particular individual contributions. How did that work out, given the power of the presidency? Obviously, he had to give them the free rein to act. But how did, specifically did they leave their imprint on the various aspects of legislation?
Sure. The thing about FDR is he was a great leader, but he didn't come into office with very definite views about these problems. He actually was a very pragmatic person. He said he believed if something worked, you should do it. If it doesn't work, try something new. So he was always on the lookout for good ideas wherever they came from, including from the Hoover administration. It was holdovers from the Hoover administration that developed the Banking Act that they passed in the first week. So he was looking everywhere, and that left the opening for people like Frances Perkins, who had very strong views. She came into office saying, we need public works. There are millions of people unemployed. They don't have a way to feed themselves. We need that. Harry Hopkins came down to Washington, D.C. with a plan for a federal welfare program and said, you know, we need to do this. And
explain the scene.
Sure.
When Harry Hopkins came to Washington, it was under a stairwell that he met Frances Perkins?
Yeah, we think now of these things as being so well planned out, but they weren't at all. Harry Hopkins, who had run the New York State welfare program, comes down to Washington eager to meet with FDR in the White House, cannot get an appointment. He calls Frances Perkins, who he knew from New York, and she says, I can meet with you, but I've got a dinner. Come by my club where I'm living. And they meet under a stairwell because they can't get a table. All the tables are taken. He hands her this program, and she says, this is great. I'm going to take it to the president and get him to adopt it. It was a very bold welfare program. A lot of federal money, a lot of federal rules, centralization. She does take it to FDR, and he does adopt it. It becomes the law. But it was literally under the stairwell that our first welfare program was developed.
And Wallace, his role, how he was chosen, and then his role within the administration?
Henry Wallace was an amazing man, a scientist, a farm journalist, and he came to Washington saying he was going to save the Farm Belt or he would just go back home to Iowa. And the Farm Belt had actually been in depression much longer than the rest of the country. They'd had a terrible 1920s. So he comes to Washington, and he goes to FDR in the first week and says, we need an agriculture plan, and FDR says, go talk to the farmers, see what they want. Wallace quickly holds a meeting of all the farm leaders. They agree to this subsidy program, which was critical then to saving the farms. And within a month or two, we had this incredibly revolutionary agriculture program that did save the farmers, save the Farm Belt. Another amazing fellow.
Adam Cohen, the subtitle of Nothing to Fear is FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. Talk about the laws that were pushed through in this critical period.
Sure. You know, the thing about this moment in time is that up until then, it was Herbert Hoover and it was free market capitalism. The federal government did very little. The entire federal budget was under $5 billion. They ran the post office. They had the military. That was about it. FDR comes in and says, we need essentially to create a social welfare state. So that's why we get things like the Federal Emergency Relief Act, $500 million for a welfare program. We get the Agricultural Adjustment Act, the first time the government really intervenes in the agriculture markets in that way. We get the National Industrial Recovery Act, which had some ham-handed attempts to get government and business to work together, but it had that $3.3 billion in public works money, which then became the WPA and other famous public works programs. These 15 bills were all passed incredibly quickly by a Congress that was willing to give FDR virtually anything he wanted because the country was in such dire straits.
I wanted to go to one of these crowning achievements of FDR's presidency, the passage of the Social Security Act. This is some of what President Roosevelt told the nation after he signed it into law. Behind him is Frances Perkins. It's August 14th, 1935.
This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health. We can never insure 100% of the population against 100% of the hazards and vicissitudes of life, but we have tried to frame a law which will give some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family against the loss of a job and against poverty-stricken old age. It seems to me that if the Senate and the House of Representatives in this long and arduous session had done nothing more than pass this Security Bill, Social Security Act, the session would be regarded as historic for all time.
That was President Roosevelt in August of 1935, 2 years after he came into office. Frances Perkins is standing behind him. She chaired the committee that pushed through Social Security. She's the first female cabinet member ever. Talk about her influence, how she came into the inner circle of FDR.
She was a completely remarkable person and a woman far ahead of her time. She came to New York after starting as a social worker, personally witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, saw the 146 girls jumping to their death, and became the leading factory reformer. She ends up joining Al Smith's.
She's the reason we have fire escapes today.
Fire escapes and fire drills and all that. Those were her suggestions. Very, very critical stuff. So she joins Al Smith's administration when FDR becomes governor. He keeps her on as industrial commissioner. And during his time as governor, she's a voice in his ear constantly. We need things like Social Security, you know, at that point at a state level. We need welfare programs. We need public works. She's this liberal voice constantly in his ear. And then she comes down to Washington with him, becomes labor secretary. And she really was the conscience of the New Deal in many ways. And yes, she chaired the Social Security Committee. And she wanted it to go further. She actually wanted it to include national health insurance. But the AMA, even back then, was very strong and opposed it. And she and a couple other progressives on the committee said, you know, we better just settle for what we can get. They didn't want to lose the whole Social Security program. But to the end of her life, when she died in 1965 as a professor at Cornell, she was still hoping that health insurance could be part of the, you know, of the welfare state.
I'd like to ask you about the lessons of all of this now, as we're facing as a new president about to take office, and a similar, though not as profound, crisis as the Depression. But there's another side to this, which is that increasingly in the United States, American capitalism, as well as in Europe, more and more power is being centralized in the state. And already, obviously, as a result of the Roosevelt reforms, you've had enormous greater centralization of power in state. Right now, President Obama has enormous powers already. What would he have to do to be able to deal with this new crisis of, again, a laissez-faire, rampant era in American capitalism?
I think that's exactly right. FDR has given him the power by making the state as strong as it is. He now needs to use it for the right purposes. And that may not be bank bailouts. It may be things like putting millions of people to work in good jobs, restoring our infrastructure. One thing that's really encouraging is it took FDR a while during the 100 days to come around to that answer. It was the National Industrial Recovery Act, the last bill of the 100 days that had that public works funding. And FDR at the beginning of the 100 days wasn't sure he supported public works. What's very encouraging is that Obama, even before he takes office, is talking about public works. He's talking about stimulus. He's talking about creating millions of jobs. So I think he gets it. And I think a lot of the reason is he is a student of history. He's been reading not only his Abraham Lincoln, but his FDR. And I think he's learning from the past and understanding we shouldn't wait to the end of the 100 days. Let's start talking about these things right now.
But you're already getting some people who are saying that his economic stimulus plan is actually not sufficient for the task. I think Paul Krugman today in the Times says it's way below what is actually needed to jumpstart an economy this big.
Right, and that's going to be the debate. It was the debate during FDR's time, too. The progressives wanted billions more, and the conservatives said there's no money at all. We're going to get that again. The Senate, McConnell, people like that are going to say there's not enough money. I agree with Krugman. Obama really needs to push for high levels of funding. The more that we can inject into the economy, the more jobs, the better it will be right now.
I was just speaking with someone who was at a Montclair fundraising party for Barack Obama a year and a half ago. And he quoted this famous quote from A. Philip Randolph when he went to FDR to demand something. And FDR turned to him and said, "Make me do it." Mm-hmm. Let's talk beyond the circle that you emphasize that surrounded FDR, really pushing him for some of these changes, the greater circle around them, people in this country. Talk about the role of activism in the changes we saw 75 years ago and where you see parallels today.
Sure. I mean, one of the other things FDR created in addition to the welfare state was the New Deal Coalition. And the New Deal Coalition incorporated lots of different groups that all voted Democratic, got the Republicans out, and FDR felt they were his constituency and he needed to keep them happy. So that included union leaders were very important, and that's why we got the right to organize was in the National Industrial Recovery Act, because the union leaders demanded that. Farmers were very important and had been fairly Republican. To keep them voting Democratic, FDR gives them, you know, a big relief program. Urban workers, the heart of the Democratic electorate, FDR gives them things like the first welfare program. So he's constantly managing all these groups. And yes, when the union people spoke out, they got more things, they pushed back. So he was very responsive to pressure of this kind, and he wanted to keep everyone in the coalition happy. So it's definitely an argument today that people who elected Obama need to tell him now what they want. You know, if they want, you know, stronger union rights, they need to tell him that and remind him how he got in office.
And of course, that New Deal coalition also included the Southern Democrats. And as a result, for many years, Roosevelt sort of delayed any action on civil rights and attempting to deal with Jim Crow. It wasn't until the 1940s, right, with the threat of the March on Washington by African Americans that he finally agreed to an executive order to attempt to begin desegregation in the U.S. government.
That's right. FDR did so much, but there were definitely some blind spots. One was race. Eleanor Roosevelt was out there all the time pushing for these people. Franklin was not. Another group was the sharecroppers. People criticized the Agricultural Adjustment Act for giving a lot of money to the big farmers, but the poor sharecroppers who were being thrown off the land were ignored for several years, and Wallace eventually began to try to take care of them. But yes, not everyone, you know, was taken care of right away.
If we see change happening because of power blocks, you look at the Obama circle, the inner circle, the cabinet he's proposed, and the organized body that has the most effect on Obama today is clearly labor, because the most progressive position within the department, within his proposed cabinet, is Hilda Solis, Department of Labor, same position that Frances Perkins occupied 75 years ago.
Absolutely true. And, you know, a lot of people were waiting for that appointment. It was the last one that Obama made. And even in Frances Perkins's time, labor was a backwater. It was the last department created. She was the last person sworn in because it was the lowliest department. But she turned it into something very powerful. And she was a huge voice at these cabinet meetings for public works and for caring for poor people. A lot of people right now are looking to Hilda Solis, who also cares very much, obviously, about the immigrant community, to be that voice in the Obama administration. It'll be very interesting to see if she can be sort of the Perkins of our time.
And already the corporate America is preparing its campaign against a major number one issue, obviously, of organized labor, which will be the Employee Free Choice Act. And there's already a huge multi-million-dollar campaign being organized to stop that legislation, isn't there?
Absolutely. But you could almost hear Obama thinking, like FDR did, you know, make me. So this is the time, really, for the labor unions to come forward on that.
The importance of speed, Adam Cohen, on the issue of these changes, pushing through these changes.
Incredibly important. And that's something the 100 Days was all about. Right now, Obama will be coming into office with incredibly high popularity, a honeymoon, people looking to him to act. This is his moment. And I think he sees that. That's why he's already talking about the stimulus package, because with day one, that will be the height of his power. Get a lot of important things through very quickly before the grumbling and the dissent and it kicks in. This is his moment, and I think he's going to seize it.
We want to thank you very much, Adam Cohen, for being with us. His new book just out this week, Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. If you'd like a copy of today's broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, and we will be doing several days of special coverage from Washington, D.C., from the inauguration, two-hour specials on Monday and Tuesday morning, Tuesday and Wednesday morning after Martin Luther King Day, the 20th and the 21st, and we'll doing live coverage of the inauguration in the afternoon of the 20th. You can go to our website for details at democracynow.org. A very special happy birthday to Peter Curry's. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fadal Kadus, Aaron Mate, Angela Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagaran, Peter Curry's our engineer. Special thanks also to Becca Staley. I'll be with Louise Erdrich on January 14th here in New York, the great author. Go to our website for details. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.